Hello and welcome to Factually Speaking. This is a new show, Friday night. The date today is the 15th, I believe. Yeah, the 15th of September 2012. And tonight I've got a fantastic co-host with me, Andrew Johnson. I'll tell you a little bit about him quickly. Andrew grew up in Yorkshire in England and graduated from Lancaster University in 1986 with a degree in computer science and physics. He mainly works in software and engineering and software development. For the past 20 years, he's also worked full and part-time lecturing and tutoring, mainly in adult education. He now works for the Open University, doing that part-time and tutoring and assessing students whilst occasionally doing freelance work on software projects. He became interested in alternative knowledge, as he calls it, in 2003, soon after discovering Dr. Stephen Greer's Discovery Project. He's also given presentations and written and posted on a number of articles for various websites surrounding 9/11, Mars, chemtrails, anti-gravity research. And whilst challenging some of the authorities to address some of the most compelling data that is available, his website is called checktheevidence.com. Fantastic website. He goes into a range of different subjects on that. And, you know, it's well worth checking out in the future. So I've got nothing interesting to tell you just yet, but I'll go straight over to Andrew. So welcome, Andrew, to the show.
Thanks very much for inviting me to come on and speak to you.
That's all right, and you know, I do appreciate you being able to make this as well. I know it's late night for a lot of people. This show, it's the best hours I could get. Everyone else has nicked all the best slots. So I wanted to start off with the talk you gave at the Kemp Freedom Movement weeks back. That's kempfreedommovement.co.ning.uk, and this was a talk that you gave up Gravesend, and it was mainly about 9/11 and Judy Wood's work on based on a book that she wrote called Where Did the Towers Go? And I thought it was a fantastic talk. I almost never nearly made it. I was actually not really in the mood for going out and listening to a lecture that night, but I changed my mind at the last minute, and God, I'm so glad I did. And it's one of the best talks I've heard there in a long time. And I was sort of conspiracy theoried out, you know, in terms of hearing another talk about 9/11 again. But you gave some fresh info, stuff that I'd never really looked into before. And I was aware of Judy Wood, Dr. Judy Wood, and her books. Mark Stevens had actually done an interview with her on his show, the No State Project, a few years ago. You should be able to find that on one of the podcasts on his on the archives on his site. But so I was a little bit more familiar with the work she was doing, but I wasn't that well up on the direct energy weaponry that's been alleged to have been used on this on these events. So that was a bit of an eye-opener for me, and it was just very thought-provoking in terms of what you was exposing about so-called other truth groups that were allegedly, you know, meant to be exposing the truth about 9/11, and it turns out that was obviously anything but. And I see this across the board. This isn't just with 9/11, this is over many subjects where we appear to have these groups up and around the world and up and down the country, and they claim to be so-called exposing certain things, but the truth is they could possibly be government agents, or at least they were started off by government agencies. So sorry, that's me ranting on.
I think a few things to sort of develop there. You know, I was very happy to come to the Kent Freedom group. I think the website's kentfreedom.ning.com, I think. I don't think it's .co.uk, but if you just put Kent Freedom Group into Google, I'm sure it'll bring that up.
And thanks so much, Chris. Yeah,
that's right. And you know, it was really, really good group there, and I got a very warm welcome. And I think one of the things that I was very pleased about was that after the event, several people actually gave me some feedback, and they contacted me, you know, and sort of some of them just said, oh, thanks for coming, and, you know, it was an interesting talk and stuff, and some folks were just asking me a few more questions, and I don't often get that, so I was very pleased that, you know, I enjoy the interaction with people, and I want to be challenged and stuff, you know, and I want to make sure that these people are actually thinking about what I've said and not just accepting it, you know.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's a terrific group they have down there, and this is what we usually have with most people who come down and give talks. No one's worried about actually going up and asking them, you know, during the breaks and afterwards, you know, and going up and asking them, you know, questions and everything. And, you know, people aren't as standoffish as you get at some events, obviously, where they're up on a big podium somewhere giving a big talk, and sometimes it can be difficult to get access to somebody to talk to them. But yeah, I mean, the facilities we've got there makes that very easy and very comfortable to do that in. So
yeah, it's a good venue, and, you know, sort of friendly people there, and you know, I had some grub before we started, you know, and in the pub upstairs and that, so that was really good, sort of set the scene for a good sort of you know, friendly atmosphere, etc. So yeah. But yeah, the actual things that I've been trying to do with that, it is very challenging for people, because I think, as you were saying, it seems to be that, you know, you've got all these official stories about 9/11 and all these other things, you know, the free man movement, health, stories about cancer and this sort of thing, the official story about cancer that there is no cure and, you know, it's chemotherapy or nothing, basically. You know, I'm exaggerating slightly, of course, but it's basically that's about it. And then when you look into the alternative side, you know, and find out about these things, you'll see there is good information there. But then there are people seemingly, you know, put there to give the appearance of presenting good information, when actually they're not. They're giving you some good information and some bad information, and they're deliberately mixing them up. And then the other people who are just there because they found this other layer of reality that they're trying to explore, they often haven't got the experience and the, you know, and the sort of toolbox to unpick it all. You know, my experience was with 9/11, and what I tried to describe in that talk was, I began to realise the official story was false in about 2004, around about that sort of time. And so that was sort of 3 years after the events, basically, more or less. And then I got into this scholars group, and I realised that, you know, that basically wasn't all that it seemed, but I still thought that they were trying to get to the truth of what happened. And, you know, and they talked about this thermite being in the buildings, and, you know, this physicist Stephen E. Jones, and I talked about my experience with him. You know, I suppose what I was able to do was, as I was going along, I was collecting my own, I was doing my own intelligence, really. I was finding out more and more about these people and keeping a track of where I'd come from and what I'd discovered. And, you know, in 2007, I started to write all these up in a series of articles, all this evidence up in a series of articles, because by that point, one of the key realizations I'd had, in large part thanks to a video somebody sent me, that the guy who was, you know, promoting this thermite story, Professor Stephen E. Jones, he had actually been involved in something called cold fusion, which was very interesting. You know, and I probably should give a little bit of an expansion on that, because, you know, we had this group called Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which was formed at the end of 2005. And as it turns out, it seems to be that this was formed as a result of a suggestion by Dr. Judy Wood. I mean, this is something I didn't go into in the talk, but apparently she met David Ray Griffin, who's the author of A New Pearl Harbor. And Dr. Wood has spoken about this on one or two of the interviews she's done. And, you know, she spoke to him about what she'd been, you know, studying, which was this billiard ball scenario that she'd used to explain the anomalous disappearance of the towers in a time which was faster than the so-called free fall time. In other words, if you were to measure, you know, look at the videos and measure the time that it took the towers to disappear, I'm not going to say collapse because they didn't actually collapse. I used to say collapse a lot. It was actually, you know, faster than this free fall time, which is impossible. and so I'd, you know, basically, she told me that that's, she had this meeting with David Ray Griffin, and she suggested getting some academics together. And then soon after that, the Scholars Group was formed a few months after that. And I was invited to join this group by none other than Stephen E. Jones and another chap called Jim Fetzer. And that group kind of set up a forum, and Stephen E. Jones set this up on an archaeology forum. He set up a sub-forum that he was involved with, because he was involved in archaeometry, which is the physics of archaeology, or parts of it. And so we started started being involved with the Scholars Group, and seemed like a good development. You know, some academics looking at this and getting some brains on it and trying to do press releases. And I thought that things were going to happen from this. But then again, there were certain things that the group didn't really want to talk about at that time. And one of the things they didn't really want to talk about was Dr. Judy Wood's billiard ball example, which was rather peculiar because, as I later discovered, being marginalised, and I hadn't really realised that this billiard ball example was there until much later, because it hadn't been discussed. And instead, we were all encouraged to talk about thermite and this side of things. So over time, over a period of about 8 or 9 months, I began to realise that things, you know, weren't quite all as they were seen. A lot of people arguing and squabbling about various things. And initially, I didn't think that mattered too much because, you know, we just needed to prove that the official story was wrong, and we already had enough evidence to do that. You know, later on, I realised that it was very important that we did look at, you know, why we had to get the story straight, in other words. And there were two reasons for that, really. One is that if you don't get the story straight, then if you're, you know, in trying to get the truth out to the public, if you haven't got the story straight, then you may be giving them a false story without realising it. And that, I think, a lot of people...
That shoots your credibility to pieces, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so if you can be shot down by other academics because you're talking rubbish, then you ain't going to get very far. And essentially, I think... You know, that's what the group was being set up to do. It was being set up to give the appearance of credibility, but when you pulled certain things apart, you find that they didn't stand up to scrutiny. I mean, this whole idea of using thermite, for example, you know, initially I thought that was legitimate, and I was led along by, you know, in particular by this Professor Stephen E. Jones, because he was... You know, he worked for Brigham Young University. I could go onto the Brigham Young University website. I could look at the physics department, and I could see him listed as a professor there. So I assumed that this guy was, you know, telling us the truth. I mean, why would he lie about something, you know, to do with 9/11 when he was supposed to be getting out the truth? But I realised, you know, essentially we caught him. In a lie, basically, because one of the things he claimed on the Alex Jones show, and I've got a recording of this, was that molten aluminium was silvery in appearance at all temperatures, and this is untrue. Certainly, if you heat aluminium up to 600 degrees centigrade, it will melt, or around about, I think it's like 600, 650 degrees centigrade, it will melt and be silvery. But if you continue to heat it up to, say, 1400, 1500 degrees, guess what? It goes orange and it loses its silvery appearance. And even in daylight conditions, he said it was silver in daylight conditions. I should add that detail because otherwise I wouldn't be quoting him correctly. And this was a lie. And I ended up posting an article about this on my website and pointing this out, that this was a basic error. Why was a physicist making this basic error? And why didn't he admit, if he didn't generally, you know, got his figures messed up, why didn't he admit it? And he never did. And in fact, what happened was I had another person writing to me. I can't remember the name of this guy. I think it was either Michael Morrissey or Frank Leggy. I think it was Frank Leggy. He wrote to me and said, "Oh, why have you got this article on your website? I think you should take it off." And I said, "Why? What's wrong with it?" And he couldn't actually point out what was wrong with it, but he still thought I should take it off. And I thought it was very peculiar because my website wasn't a particularly, you know, I get a little bit more traffic now, but it's not, you know, my website doesn't get a huge lot of traffic. It's not, I think it's like 300 visitors a day or something. It's not like thousands and thousands. And so I'm thinking, why is this guy writing to me asking me to take this article off? And he and I became more and more suspicious. And then it was around that time that I found out that Stephen E. Jones had a history. And what he'd been involved with in the late 80s and early 90s was this, as I mentioned earlier, this thing called cold fusion. And it's very, very important that people look into this because what it reveals ultimately, you know, and we'll probably get to this, is that 9/11 wasn't just to do with things like, trying to invade Afghanistan and trying to portray that these Muslim countries with a predominantly Muslim population had harboring terrorists. It wasn't to do with that, and it wasn't necessarily to do with getting control of oil supplies, nor was it to do with manipulating the world financial markets. I mean, it might have been, it seems to be to do with, you know, those things, but there's another thing that it's to do with which people don't talk about. And even now, 5 years after this information was revealed, people still don't talk about it. Very few, apart from myself and Dr. Judy Wooden. I could probably name about six or seven others who have picked up on this. And that is that there is an energy connection to the events of 9/11. And it is my contention, because of Stephen E. Jones's involvement in 2005, that he was put there because he was tasked with diverting the focus of attention away from certain types of evidence which were available in the public record. And it was exactly and precisely that sort of evidence which had caught Dr. Judy Wood's attention. And she'd been collecting that evidence since about 2004, and she'd posted it on a few web pages. And in 2006, she published a sort of whole long article about what she called energy effects seen in the debris and in the aftermath of the destruction of the World Trade Center. And this went on to become what was called the Star Wars Directed Energy Weapon paper or series. I don't think she called it a paper, because basically what it was really was a set of pictures and a set of captions, and she compared, for example, certain types of energy release, such as the energy release from a nuclear test. And at that point, she was merely showing the characteristics that there was an energy release, a large energy release, involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. Now, she didn't at that time say where that energy had come from. She didn't know what the source of that energy was. But over a period of several months to a couple of years, she began to piece together the evidence as to where that energy had come from. Meanwhile, Stephen E. Jones is very busy. Just after the NIST reports came out, NIST, I must add, is a US government agency, a bit like our Department of Trade and Industry to some extent. NIST is the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And they were tasked with producing a set of reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center. And they came out in August 2005, 10,000 pages of reports, and they cost about $16 million. And NIST had produced these reports using 23 contractors, including several, or at least two, I should say, that did work for the U.S. military. And those two companies that did some of this work on the NIST reports and also work for the U.S. military or do research and development for them are Science Applications International Corporation and Applied Research Associates, which I'll probably talk a bit more about in a few minutes. But so Jones appeared on the scene talking about thermite, not talking about energy. And in fact, he then went on to try and discredit any of the talk about energy effects being involved. And he started calling this study that Dr. Wood had put together, that he said she talked about ray beams from space or space beams, which tried to give it sort of, you know, ridicule it into a sort of science fiction type of context. But she never actually used that phrase. Never used that phrase. So I thought, well, you know, if you're going to... if you're going to actually fairly criticise this, you should at least use the correct language and terminology to describe it and not try to ridicule it, because you're supposed to be a person who is looking into 9/11 and challenging the official story of what happened, and therefore you shouldn't be worried about being ridiculed, because most people at that time, and still are, ridiculing people who question the official story of 9/11. So, I, you know, I was getting red flags raised in my mind about that and at the time. And anyway, so I later read Dr. Eugene Malov's book. And Dr. Eugene Malov, he used to work for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he became interested in the cold fusion developments in the late 1980s. And there were two I'll explain what cold fusion is. There's very large sums have been invested in both nuclear fission technology. Nuclear fission is what is used in all the nuclear power stations, and it creates all these very toxic radioactive substances, because what the basic principle behind nuclear fission is that you have a uranium compound, U-235, and you enrich that and purify it. And then when you collect a certain amount of uranium-235 together, it starts to undergo a nuclear reaction, and you have to get what's called a critical mass of uranium. And it starts to release neutrons, which then cause the rest of the uranium to break down. And you can then get a nuclear reaction where a very small amount of matter is turned into energy as these atoms of uranium split up into smaller compounds, including strontium and cesium, and also plutonium can be produced as well. And over the years, since the early and mid 40s, since this technique was developed, a lot of money has been invested in building nuclear power stations, nuclear weapons, and so on. And there is another form of nuclear power which has also had a great deal of money invested in, and that's called nuclear fusion. And this uses the opposite approach. Uranium is a very big atom, as its molecular weight, its atomic weight rather, is 235, and I forget what the atomic number is, but it's roughly half that. And with fission, what you can do is you can get very tiny atoms, actually the tiniest atom, which is hydrogen, and you encourage these tiny atoms to fuse together and form helium, and that is also a nuclear reaction from which you can derive energy. And then you can you can hopefully extract that energy and use it. The problem with that is that you have to put a lot of energy in before you get any energy out, and they use various techniques such as very high powered lasers, and they have to use some type of magnetic containment, And if you go and look at, you know, you could go and look this up on Wikipedia, nuclear fusion power, you will find that, I don't recommend Wikipedia as a source, but it always comes up. You can hardly avoid it. Or you could look it on a university website if you wanted. And you would find that fusion power of this nature has always been 20 years away. And they've spent billions and billions of dollars on it since about the 1950s. However, in 1989, two electrochemists called Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann said that they'd performed a simple experiment in a beaker or a large kind of large test tube with this special type of electrolytic cell that they'd devised, which used a palladium cathode and a solution of lithium hydroxide, which had had deuterated water added to it. And from this experiment, when they arranged things in a particular way, it appeared that they were getting a nuclear reaction going on in the water. And this was a no-no. You couldn't have this. You couldn't have nuclear reactions happening without radioactive materials, of which they didn't. Well, they had deuterated water, which is mildly radioactive, but not really any harmful radioactivity. You don't have to wear any special protective clothing or anything like that. And then they basically said that in some of their experiments, not all of them, they were getting out more energy, slightly more energy than they were putting in. In other words, if they put 100 watts of power in, they were getting 120 watts out. And again, that all the physicists said, well, that's not possible. You can't get energy from nowhere. You've always got to expend some energy to get some energy out. And they said, no, that's what we found. Stephen E. Jones was one of the people that said, oh yes, I've done this fusion research as well in a different form. I've done muon catalyzed cold fusion, so I know that you can get fusion outside of a nuclear fission or fusion reactor. It does happen, but you can't get any energy out of it. My experiments show that you just get fusion and no energy. And so basically, Stephen E. Jones was doing what he did with 9/11 at that time. He was saying that this fusion, this different type of fusion was real, but it was of no use. You couldn't get any energy out of it. And he said in 9/11 research that, the official story about the way the buildings came down from fire is wrong, but it was thermite that probably did it, not the collapse.
Go on.
So basically, he was doing a limited hangout, and that you can find out more about that in Eugene Malov's book in terms of the cold fusion, because Eugene Malov found out that when, just to finish this bit off, Eugene Malov found out that when another university, in other words, the university that he was at, tried to reproduce Pons and Fleischmann's experiment, which was a fairly simple experiment. You just needed some fairly common materials. The report that Massachusetts Institute of Technology produced said that they didn't get this situation where, they had more energy coming out than they'd put in. What Malov worked out is they hid that. They hid that that's what had happened. And he then realized that they'd committed fraud, and he ended up resigning from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and then he went and formed this New Energy Foundation, and that was really the start of Eugene Malov's journey into alternative energy sources.
Yeah, so basically they've had this alternative energy source for many years now. And obviously, still as best as they're trying, they obviously want to keep this quiet from the public.
Well, this is it.
The stories from. Sorry, go on.
Well, so all I was going to say is that this story is a very long one, and in fact, I'm sure you've heard of Nikola Tesla and his research, and that seems to be one of the routes to free energy. He came out with various inventions in the sort of 1900s, And it appears that some of his inventions and experiments allowed people to get more energy out than they would put in, than they would be put into an experiment. And his research was eventually shut down by J.P. Morgan, one of the bankers, I think in the sort of 1920s, when they realised that what Tesla was proposing was a free energy system, you know, they couldn't really easily meet to that. And, you know, some of that actually later, when you study the evidence that Dr. Judy Wood has put together, that it appears to be a link to some of the work of Nikola Tesla, but that's essentially through another person called John Hutchison. But I suppose really the key piece of evidence, and you know, you probably remember this from the talk, one of the key pieces of evidence which begins to show you this energy effect is this segment of the spire, as it's called, this section of 70 stories of unsupported steel turning to dust before your very eyes. And you can see this, you know, you probably remember me showing that
video of it,
And
it was amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see this, you know, we've got multiple clips of this, two or three independent sets of still photographs where you can see this happening, and you can clearly see that this is an effect that you've never seen before, outside of a movie, basically. And this is one of the key effects. It's not the only one, as some people claim. Some people claim this is the only effect that needs to be explained. It isn't. There are many others that Dr. Wood catalogued. And
sorry, go on.
What energy caused this thing to actually turn to dust? You know, you can actually see it turning to dust because
that's right. We see it sort of. It splits apart four ways, almost, the way we see it come down. And you're right, yeah, if you look at it carefully, and when someone puts that that concept in your head, that is actually what you're seeing. You start to see it a lot more clearly, what's really happening in front of you when you watch those buildings come down. And, I remember with Richard D. Hall, I went to see one of his talks a few months back, and he was talking a lot about the effects of the planes actually hitting the building. And when you started looking at how he was presenting it to you, you were starting to realise you wasn't seeing, it's not very likely you was actually seeing a real plane hit that building. Now, to a lot of people, that sounds absolutely bonkers. Of course there was a plane there. But it appears, along with this direct energy weaponry they may have technology to actually produce holograms in the sky.
Well, this is the
thing. I believe this thing could possibly have been that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it is very problematic, and it's funny because just this week I have been accused by somebody. You'd probably know his name if I told you, but I won't tell you his name. He accused me of being the reason why the UK 9/11 truth movement has collapsed. And really, essentially, why he said that was because we stay focused on the evidence, i.e., as you were sort of outlining there, that if you study the evidence for the plane crashes at the World Trade Center, you find that it doesn't add up. And the plane crashes themselves didn't look like the crashes of a real plane. In other words, you know, if you look at the holes in the building before the buildings were destroyed, you can't have a plane-shaped hole in a building like the World Trade Center, which physically would not happen.
It's a cartoon effect, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and people have called it a cartoon plane and stuff. You know, and some people think it's, you can't tell people that. Well, it's actually, you know, the point is that you have to present the truth. You have to present the evidence. Now, where that then takes you, you know, you could just leave it at that and say, you know, this plane crash can't have been real, and then just move on to the next thing. You know, you don't have to go down what might have caused the hole to appear.
Exactly. You can just show people the facts, what they was really seeing that day. Whether you can explain it or not's another thing.
But exactly.
If you can at least present the facts that, if at least you can present the facts that the official story is obviously a pack of lies, and can't possibly be, you know, get anywhere near to the truth of what really happened, that then that can be enough to start getting people to start questioning all of it and start maybe coming around to believing that, or at least, you know, starting to see that it's possible that whatever we're trying to claim this could be, you know, could be right, whatever exotic technology they're using. Because this is the thing, once you come about doing it that way, and obviously, you know, showing people the facts, you can hold your own in any forum from that point on. So if they want to attack you, that's fine, but you've got the evidence and you've got the facts to back up what you're saying. And as long as you're not giving your own opinions and starting to go off into wild, fantasies and everything about what you think really happened, as long as you just stick to the facts, you can always hold your own against anybody who's going to criticise you. I mean, I've come under attack myself, certain things I've said. So's Mark Stevens, who I, I try to emanate with what I'm trying to do over here in England. And he's come under attack himself. People call him a nutcase and everything, way he deals with things. But at the end of the day, he can hold his own regardless of what the attack is going to be. He'll just present the facts to people. And it's like, well, it's up to me to... It's like with a lot of things, you can get people to agree with you with certain facts along the way, but it's the conclusion they don't like. So you don't always have to give them your conclusion, but, yeah, as long as you present them with the facts, well, yeah, that's good enough.
Right, you have to stick to the evidence and the facts that you can show and you can prove, and then, you know, I found that leads you towards a certain type of explanation. And, for example, one of the things with the hole in the building, you know, it was claimed that this was caused by a plane, but then when Dr. Wood had done this other research, you know, about the energy effects, she decided at some point to look at the Earth's magnetic field and what had happened to it. And there's a set of instruments in Alaska which continually monitor the Earth's magnetic field and the strength of it. And these instruments are separated by, I think, several tens of miles across Alaska. And, for example, she found that the Earth's magnetic field was behaving very erratically throughout the events of 9/11. And then the sort of day before and the day after, it was much more stable. And, you know, one of the slides that I stole from her for the talk that I gave last week was this showing of the Earth's magnetic field at 8:46. And you can see that this trace from one of these instruments, or in fact six of these instruments, there were six different instruments in this trace, the trace had reached a minimum at 8:46, which was exactly the time that the Tower 1 got its hole. And this trace started to deflect from a sort of like an average position, a sort of linear average position, about 20 minutes earlier. And then immediately after that hole appeared, the trace started to go back up to the average level again. So you can clearly see there's an absolute defined correspondence between the Earth's magnetic field changing and this instance of this supposed plane crash. And it becomes very, very difficult to rule that out as a coincidence. So it's by looking at these very wide-ranging sets of data. I mean, when she showed me that, this was probably 3 years ago, I think, 4 or 5 years ago now, I can't remember, it was a few years ago now, I thought, well, who else has looked at this? Who else has seen it? And you then lifted onto a kind of, well, what the hell was this kind of level? You know, and it becomes very challenging, because if you were just to go up to somebody in the pub, you know, and I think I mentioned this at the end of the talk, to say, oh, you know, it wasn't Al-Qaeda that did 9/11, it was an energy weapon. They say, oh, get lost, you know, it's just ridiculous. You know, you've had too many beers, or, you know, have you taken the pills today, or whatever, you know, sort of expression. And it becomes very difficult, because until you can spend, you know, 10, 20 minutes going through this with people, they wouldn't have, they would have no clue that what you're on about, you know. I mean, if you show them, and that's why you need these pictures. You know, I made myself a little A4 booklet, which I sometimes carry around with me, and then I've got about 10 or 12 of these pictures in it, and I can talk people through. And I found that actually works, you know, quite well to show people, because if you just describe it, they'll just think, well, obviously this guy's, he doesn't know what he's seeing. You know, he's read the picture wrong, or the picture's been, you know, taken from somewhere and he's just mistook it for something else. They can think all those kinds of things until you actually put it in front of their eyes and describe it. And it's just, you know, and then the other thing which, you know, which we should bring up, which I always try and mention because it's, again, people have, hardly anybody has heard of it, and this is the Hurricane Erin data, which is just, I mean, it just sends you completely onto a different plane, really, of what's been happening, because Hurricane Erin was one of the most ever studied hurricanes. I think they had teams from 10 different universities studying it. It formed in the mid-Atlantic in 2001 on the 1st of, about the 1st, it was given a name on the 1st of September. And then by the 7th of September, it had made its way across to Bermuda and it did a bit of damage there. And then following that, it was said on CNN that it was going out to sea and no one should worry about it. And it went out to sea all right, in a straight line, right towards New York City. And guess what? At 8 o'clock in the morning on 9/11, just before the events unfolded, it was closest to New York City. And then on the 12th of September, it had made a right-hand turn and it headed out off towards Newfoundland. So if somebody is telling me that that's a coincidence, then I'm sorry, I'm going to say, I don't think you're right. And you can, and you can go and look at that data. You know, I went and looked at it on the UK Met Office site. I looked at it on the Canadian Hurricane Data Centre and the US NOAA site. And the data all says the same. That's exactly what the hurricane did. That's not a theory. You know, it's not something that's been made up. It's something that's real. And when you confront people with that, and I've confronted people with this. You know, I wrote to the government propaganda arm, Act on CO2, which is a government propaganda office set up to promote the idea of carbon dioxide-based global warming, which is another scam, a very much an ongoing scam, just like 9/11 is. I wrote to them, and they should know about these things. They should have some expertise on the weather. And I wrote to them, I said, okay, so how do you explain this hurricane that was closest to New York City at 8 o'clock in the morning on 9/11? And they wrote back and said, well, it was hurricane season then. And I wrote back and I said, well, yes, I know it was hurricane season. And I do know, you know, you can look this up easily, that the hurricane season in America runs from, I don't know, whatever it is, late August to late November or something. I can't remember the exact dates, but I knew that September the 11th was in hurricane season. I already knew that. So I had to write back to them and point out again that it was just, you know, as the events of 9/11 were unfolding, that this thing was actually there closest and then moved off the next day. And they wrote back to me and said, I have nothing to add to my previous letter. So this is what you get from people who are supposed to know about this stuff. They can't deal with it. You know, they have no way, they have no way of dealing with it because they have no clue. They won't even look into it. And if they did, you know, frankly, their world would fall apart.
That's right. Yeah, so a lot of people, they're scared or they're warned off usually in some cases, isn't it? So, but I mean, it's something I wanted to touch on regarding the weather that day. So, I mean, the theory could possibly be, I think, as you mentioned in your talk, it's possible that they needed that hurricane there in terms of, so they could use the weapon that they did, you know, this direct energy weapon.
Right.
But they needed the weather there to help orientate it or whatever. Was that the theory?
Well, you know, again, we don't know exactly what the role of the hurricane was. You know, I've talked about this before over the last few years. And, basically, we should perhaps give a bit of background because, you know, you really need to look at Dr. Judy Wood's website. And if you Google Dr. Judy Wood New Horizons, you should find a couple of YouTube videos that I posted last year where she goes through all of this evidence. And just to give you, you know, a little bullet point list of some of the things we've got. for example, upside down cars were found. We've got circular holes in the tops of the building. We've got almost no building debris. In other words, all the, nearly about 85-90% of the buildings was turned to dust completely. We've got people reporting these cars being exploding whilst they're walking down the street. You know, and this is all some distance away from the World Trade Center. We've got people being levitated. We've got effects on the Bankers Trust building, which seem to continue after the events of 9/11. You know, all kinds of strange things. We've got a section of the World Financial Center, which is across the road, which was all made out of marble, blue marble. All that section of marble disappeared just after the towers came down. But the rest of the front of that, apart from the windows, showed no real damage. The rest of the front of the World Financial Center. So whatever effect was affecting the World Trade Center was affecting it selectively. It was selectively affecting materials. And bombs don't do that. You know, jet fuel and collapsing buildings and things flying out from collapsing buildings don't affect materials selectively. If you get a chunk of steel coming off a building, it'll make a dent in a rock or it'll crash through a window. You know, it won't crash through a window and then leave the rock, you know, undamaged. And it won't turn some cars upside down and leave other ones the right way up. You know, I mean, how many other people, I don't know how long you've been looking at 9/11, but how many people that you've heard talking about 9/11 in all the 9/11 stuff that you've listened to, have you heard speaking about cars upside down next to the World Trade Center?
Yeah, you don't hear them talking about that. The focus is always on those buildings and nothing else. That's right.
Yeah, or either just the buildings, or they'll talk about, you know, the missing hijackers, or, you know, the passport that survived on the pavement, or, you know, or what Bush did in the school. You know, any number of things that they'll talk about. These phenomena, which you can see in the evidence, you can see in the photographs. They're not talked about, and then again, that was one of the themes of my talk, that people like architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, who you'd think would be interested in talking about these phenomena, they won't talk about them. And indeed, if you as a member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and I don't know if there are any listeners that are familiar with this group and have joined up with us and signed their petition, but you can do, if there are, you can do a little test. You could join, in fact, if you want, you could join up to their petition, because their website is still active, and see if I'm correct. And go on and put a little, you know, set up a profile on there, because apparently you can log on and sign in with a username, say that you agree with the petition, and then go on and put a little bit of about yourself, put a bit of background if you want. And I know a couple of people that have done this. In fact, I know three people that have done this. And then go on to your profile and type in, well, I've been looking at Dr. Judy Wood's website, and I think she's right about this energy weapon evidence, and then leave it for 48 hours, and you'll probably find that your profile gets edited, or you'll get kicked off the petition, and you'll find that any reference to Dr. Judy Wood's website or research has been expunged from your profile. So why would this be, when this group is claiming to want to look into the evidence of what happened on 9/11, you know, and why would it be that the person who heads up this group, Richard Gage, says that Dr. Judy Wood's research, if she ignores the evidence of thermite, which incidentally she doesn't ignore the evidence of thermite, she actually points out that it's not evidence of thermite at all. Richard Gage says that when she does that, she's practicing witchcraft. I mean, isn't that exactly the same as the sort of language that's used on the mainstream media? I mean, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, it's even worse in the American media than it is ours. That we're a little bit more conservative about the language they tend to use. But I mean, it's almost a childish reaction to it, isn't it?
And of course, what it really means, as I see things, is that the guy has nothing with which to respond. He knows, in other words, he knows that an energy weapon was involved. He's been told to tell people that it wasn't that. And in fact, if you read my book, which is free, it's called 9/11 Finding the Truth, and you can download it from my website, and there's various versions I've made now. There's a Kindle version, iPad version, PDF version. There's an audiobook version, which I'm currently updating thanks to the work of somebody called Cindy Laverty, who's done a readout of it all for me, which is wonderful. And that will basically explore, you know, what's been happening with this Architects and Engineers group and various other groups, which basically, when they're presented with this evidence, they just say, no, anything but that. It's not that. You know, Dr. Judy Woody's wrong. She's an idiot. She doesn't talk about this. Therefore, it must be that, not that. Any excuse they can come up with, you know, they'll say it's not.
If their reality can't fit the facts, then yeah, they'll reject
right.
it.
Right. I think it's two things. For some people, it's just that their reality can't accept it. But I think for the people like Stephen E. Jones, you know, he knows he's been given. I would say he's been told that he must not allow people to get a grip on this energy, you know, phenomena. He's been told that he has to do things to move people away from that. And I think it's fairly clear that, and he's done it successfully as well. And this second level of cover-up, as we call it, a second tier of cover-up, has been a huge success. You know, and I've now got a few people writing to me saying, you know, from time to time, not very many, only a few saying, oh, you know, I used to believe in this thermite stuff, but now I've seen it. It's, you know, what you said is difficult to accept, but now that I've studied it and, you know, looked at all the evidence, I'm having a real trouble actually understanding what else it could be. You know, I thought it was just crazy at first, but now I'm seeing that it's more and more fits the evidence, more, you know, the evidence fits what you're saying more and more, you know. And it's something of a personal realization that you've got to come to, because you ain't going to get it from any official source. And that includes all of the 9/11 truth groups.
Yeah, you've got to question absolutely everything, even when you believe that somebody's being honest with you and giving you a true account of what happened. You've still got to question it. Don't swallow it. Don't take it for granted. And that's, I mean, that talk that you gave me, you know, talk at the KFM the other day. I mean, that's what got me, even with what I'll do, it got me thinking a little deeper about it, even with what I'm studying and that. You know, cause it's not just this, it's everything that they're trying to hide from us. This is, like you said, this is a conspiracy within a conspiracy. This whole thing's huge. It's on so many levels, and it's not just one thing they're trying to cover up. It's many things. I mean, obviously, it's the energy issue. Like you say, that seems to be one of the main issues regarding this. But, it's conspiracies within conspiracies. And it's not conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy facts. We know what these people are getting up to in that sense.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah, I mean, Pondy asked the question. He goes, what do you think about the possibility of the same weapon being deployed now?
I don't know
what it means, what context that could be used in. Maybe they could use it in the wars that they're trying to kick off in the Middle East, maybe.
Well, it remains a possibility that they could use it again, and there's a couple of things that I will say on that. I mean, before I do that, I'll just give a quick rundown of you know, because I've mentioned a bit about the energy effects and so on, but people that are not familiar with this might be a bit in the dark as to what I'm talking about. Okay. So I'll just do sort of a couple of minutes on that, and then I'll go to the question that's just been asked. So thank you for the question. And we talked before about these energy effects, and well, what am I talking about? Well, Dr. Wood, as for example, has catalogued several specific effects in the evidence. One is, for example, these bent beams, where we've got several beams that are bent into a horseshoe shape from the World Trade Center. We've had most of the buildings turned to dust. We've had these people and these cars being levitated, and we've got David Hansher's account, for example. He was levitated and carried a block. We've got upside down cars. We've got the appearance of very strange fires, with a raging car fire next to paper that's not burning. And, you know, people claim that these buildings were burned down or blown up. Well, if that's true, then how did all the paper survive? Because paper burns either, you know, in a jet fuel fire or in an ex- fire from bombs, you know, and in either case you'd get that, you'd get the paper burned, but we saw lots and lots of paper that survived. So that seems to be some type of energy effect. And we had exploding oxygen tanks as well. Some of the firemen reported that oxygen tanks on their trucks were spontaneously exploding, you know, away from the building. And then we had these cars on FDR Drive, about half a mile away from the World Trade Center, which apparently had toasted effects on them, where the upholstery was unburned, yet the outside of the car appeared to be burned. So we had this evidence of heat and no heat together. Now, what we found is, or what Dr. Wood found, is that some of these effects, in fact most of them, had already been achieved in somebody's laboratory, and that laboratory belonged to a chap called John Hutchison, who's an independent Canadian researcher who's been performing experiments on various things, really. He was trying to reproduce the work of Nikola Tesla between 1979 and the present day, and he was beaming into his sample area different types of energy, such as what's called RF, or radio frequency energy, from radio frequency generators that are used to generate radio signals of various types for testing purposes and so on, and for modulating, you know, radio signals onto. He was also introducing microwave energy from microwave generators. He was introducing electrostatic fields, either from a Van de Graaff generator or from Tesla coils, and he was introducing magnetic fields from electromagnets and so on. So he was doing this and getting some very peculiar effects, such as metal bent into a horseshoe shape. He was getting things being levitated and flying up in the air. And he was getting metal effects, toasted metal effects. And he was seeing these weird fires, where fires would appear on little models that he had made whilst he was subjecting them to these combination of energies. Yet there was no apparent fuel. You know, they didn't appear to be hot fires that would consume all of the thing that they were burning on. And he'd seen these effects over a number of years. And guess what? A person that went to see him in 1983, because they'd heard about the experiments he was doing, was a certain Colonel John Alexander. And I didn't mention this in the talk, but Colonel John Alexander worked for, at the time, he was representing Los Alamos National Laboratories, which, believe it or not, was where they developed the atomic bomb. And guess which laboratory Professor Steve Nee Jones has also done work for?
Ooh.
You guessed it, Los Alamos National Laboratories. So these guys at Los Alamos, they know something. I would contend that they're one of the groups of people that may not know who did 9/11, but they know who did, you know, they know who knows, basically. They know who knows who did it. I would suspect that's the same with John Alexander. Now, when Dr. Wood made the link to the Hutchison effect, and I kind of at that time was looking over her shoulder, so to speak, and we went and did a radio interview. This was at the beginning of 2008. And we spoke about this on the Ambrose Lane program. There's a video of this that I made, actually. And just right at that time, we then found that there was a campaign started to try and discredit John Hutchison. I've written about this in my book. Within 16 hours of us broadcasting that, there was a person that we knew who essentially started a discrediting campaign against John Hutchison, which went on for at least 6 months. And you can read about that in my book. So which the timing of that was very interesting. So we looked at the timing of many of these things. So now to go back to the question that the person had asked, sorry, I forgot the name, about the weapon being used again. Well, there's actually a little story I can tell in relation to that, because in 2007, before I actually met Dr. Wood in person, this is written about in my book, we were contacted by Frank Ferguson, and he pointed out that he was somewhat concerned because there'd just been a law passed in relation to the continuity of government in the USA. And I believe that this law meant that the responsibility for the continuity of government had transferred from one government agency to another. I believe it had gone from Homeland Security to another agency. I'm not sure which one it was. And then at the same time, we had Michael Chertoff, you know, he'd had a few appearances on the media, saying that Al-Qaeda had probably got access to ex-Soviet warheads, and they were probably going to use them. So he was expecting them to come into the US and blow something up with a nuke. I can't remember his exact words, but you could go and Google that and find out his exact words. And curiously, I'd listened to a 9/11 Truth Group meeting from June 2007, and it was with this Professor Stephen E. Jones and Dr. Bill Deagle talking about a possible nuke attack, and I played this part of this clip at the talk, but I didn't tell the rest of this story, or this account. They talked about a possible nuke attack happening on an unnamed American city. So I'm thinking, hang on a minute, we've got Michael Chertoff saying Al-Qaeda nukes, we've got Stephen E. Jones and Bill Deagle saying American City could be nuked at this point by this secret group, not Al-Qaeda, because they'd already obviously tried to move away from that. And then we'd had this change in the law. So we put these three things together and said, hang on a minute, what if they were to use the weapon again somewhere in the world and claim it was an Al-Qaeda nuke? In other words, nukes are detectable. You can detect them from radiation. And they do have, you know, various equipment around the world to detect nuclear bombs. They are detectable. So if anybody was to try and actually bring a device through any security, you know, gates or whatever, the regular military, the regular guys who don't know about this stuff that I'm talking about, which is real, it's not a theory, they would pick up on it. So they would be able to detect a conventional nuke if such a thing was in the wrong hands. I've no doubt about that. They have the means to do that. However, this weapon, which we don't know where it is, we don't know exactly how it operates. We know that it operates on the principle of what's called field interference, because that's what John Hutchison does. We know that that's a very important concept in relation to how this weapon works. So in other words, they could set this weapon off. But if you go and look at the pictures on Dr. Judy's website and don't look at any of the, you know, text much, it does look like a nuclear bomb has gone off. And indeed, people have tried to say that since. Dmitry Karlazov is one example, and I've written all this up about these so-called nukers. And we had another one called Jeff Prager, who created a lot of trouble recently with this nonsense he posted. I had to write an article about that as well to point out what he was up to. So the effects look nuclear. And so basically we were going on this Ambrose Lane program, and we were invited to go on, I can't remember, I think it was something like July the 25th, 2007. And we were invited to go on this program and talk about what I've just told you. You know, we weren't saying that we were going to nuke a city. We didn't know that. We were just saying that it looked like they were trying to set something up as a possible option for a false flag and so on. And guess what? We were due to go on this program and make these comments, you know, for about half an hour or something like that. And we never got the call. The call never came, and we never went on air. And we found out the next day that Ambrose Lane had been fired from his radio program. He actually went into the station as normal to do the broadcast, but before he went on air, he was told he'd been fired. And indeed he was, and he never went back on that station. So isn't it just a bit strange that we'd sort of come up with this and we were going to discuss it, and he was fired, and his station had quite a number of listeners because he was on a satellite channel, so he had a fair few listeners. He wasn't on his local program at the time. I think that's a rather peculiar story, really, that we should have that effect on something.
Mm. I mean, it's not the fact that they are. These people who are behind this seem to care whether people are actually waking up to the fact that they were behind it, and it was obviously an inside job. They're more worried about protecting the technology behind this.
That's a very good point, Vin. Yeah, that's I think that's key. They do have to protect this technology and protect the knowledge of it, because you know, I want to point out that this isn't a theory. This is now known as far as I'm concerned. I don't regard this as a theory. I know other people will and do and will, and they've, that one of the things that this Jim Fetzer character who I mentioned briefly has been doing, he's been trying to portray this research as a theory, but it's not a theory. What it actually is two sets of evidence. One set of evidence discusses what actually happened at the World Trade Center. This is in Dr. Wood's book and the videos and so on. And the other set of evidence is what John Hutchison has been doing and some of the effects he's been seeing. And basically all that she's done is shown that these two sets of evidence are a very close match. And there is no theory involved in that. It's simply a presentation that's showing that this set of evidence matches that set of evidence. And therefore, these effects match. It would appear that the technologies involved, and we know what John Hutchison's technology is, you know, he doesn't try and keep it a secret. He's got a whole long list of equipment he uses, and I've posted that on his website. That's what this evidence is. It's not a theory, but there's a whole scrambling among these truth groups and various other people, I might add, that this, they say it's a ridiculous theory or an unproven theory or a hypothesis or a thesis. It's none of those things. It's actually an analysis of two sets of evidence. And where you go with it, you know, whether you go into the US military industrial complex with it, whether you say it's, you know, the Jesuits did it or, you know, or whatever it is, you know, we can't go there because we don't have the evidence. Other people do go there and probably will, you know, and have gone there and so on, but yes. We can't go there because we don't have the evidence. So
we don't really have to make that an issue because when, as I've heard said before, when the boot of government's on your neck, it doesn't matter whether it's left or right.
Yeah,
it's not so much the people who are behind it. We'll probably never get to who was really behind it. But what we can at least show is that obviously they're the official account of it's a load of codswallop, and obviously what's what evidence we've got to show what possibly did happen. But we can't get to the bottom of the entire thing, but we've at least got enough to prove. You know, to prove what we're trying to show people. You know, we're trying to wake people up to, you know, you're being lied about it top to bottom. Even these alleged so-called truth movement groups the 9/11 groups are not all they're claiming to be.
Right.
And like I'm saying, I don't think that just affects the 9/11 groups. I think this could possibly be a problem within a lot of groups.
Undoubtedly it is. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, all the sort of, like I say, the alternative health groups. I mean, we've got people like Rima Labo, who is one of the people involved with the alternative sort of health freedom movement. Yet she is the wife of General Albert Stubblebine, who was, involved in the psychic spies program, the remote viewing program, you know. You've got to watch out for these connections. And a lot of people I'm finding, like Jim Fetzer, for example, who ran the Scholars Group, he's ex-Navy, he was ex-military. I think he was in the, I forget what he was in, U.S. Marine Corps, I think he was in. So, you find this again and again, that there are these military connections, and I'm just, to go back to the person that asked the question as well, and I'll then just do a bit more on the energy thing slightly. basically, one of the other issues that Dr. Wood had looked at is the similarity between the destruction of World Trade Center Building 6 and the Alfred P. Murrah Building. And she's got two pictures taken from the inside of each of these buildings, and you can see the damage is very, very similar. And not only that, but I made a little posting about this a few months ago. If you look at some of the damage near the Alfred P. Murrah Building, guess what we've got? We've got these toasted cars as well, a few tens of meters away from the main building. And one of the key things that you find with some of these cars is that their trunks are open. And after the bomb has gone off, the trunks are open, as if the energy that's used has affected the material in the latch, you know, in the lock, but not the actual actual trunk or the hood, the trunk or the boot, as we would call it. It's not affected that material as much, and the trunks pop open, the boot pops open, and we've seen that with some of the World Trade Center cars as well. So it appears that I would contend that they use some version of the weapon on the Alpha P Mirage building as well. But we don't appear to have any matching sort of weather data from that. So that's you know, they could have used something else at that time.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the point you made was it's not the fact that we should call this thing a weapon. It's the fact that they've weaponized it.
Yeah.
It's not so much that but potentially. What this technology can do for us in terms of energy and everything else is incredible. They've twisted it and perverted it into using it in that sense.
Exactly.
Whenever they come across this type of technology, they always want to weaponize it. They never want to use it for anything good. They want to do something. They want to make something. Use it as a form of destruction as opposed to doing something positive with it.
This appears to be the pattern, sadly, and it's sad to have to confront this. And I mean, if I can give a sort of plug, because I've got another event coming up in Derby. I don't actually live in Derby, it's my closest city that I live in. I live just outside Derby. Yep. At the end of the month, on the 30th of September, and we've got Neil Sanders coming, who's going to talk about mind control. And we've got Richard D. Hall, who's going to, you've already mentioned, you'll saw him, he'll be doing a similar talk to what he did on his tour. And then we've got Lloyd Pye talking about the Star Child Squad. And Lloyd Pye was obviously at the Kent Freedom Movement when we did the talk there. He came along and did a quick surprise 10 minutes for folks there, which I was pleased about. Mm-hmm.
That blew my mind, that did, especially when we were talking about the genetic stuff as well. So
absolutely.
I think he's given a talk in London.
He should be on the 29th. Yeah, I think he believes he's given one in London on the 29th. I'm not sure who's organising that. I hope they get that link up on his website. It might be Belinda McKenzie that's involved with that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, he's... and I'm going to be... Why I mentioned that event, why I mentioned it is... The energy thing and the 9/11 thing, I'm going to be expanding on the energy side of that. It's a talk I've given before. It's not a new talk. So the actual main bit of the talk is already on my website, and it's called Infinite Energy But Not For The Masses. And I want to expand, that's where I try and expand on some of this energy research, which I think, again, from a slightly different angle, to me, what happened at the World Trade Center proves that we can have a completely different type of energy system. Doesn't require any fuel. It actually derives energy from some level within the material, maybe even another dimension. And John, this is something John Hutchison has talked about, this way that dimensions may be important in the energy question and where energy can be derived from. And this isn't considered in physics much. It is sort of in this what they call the string theory. They never bring that into the idea of being really able to engineer it and exploit it. And what 9/11 proves is that this energy field has already been engineered. There is no question. It's not a theory. Somebody knows how to do it. And my understanding is, look at some of the other stuff, is that this has been known about for probably at least 50 years. And I do think that at some level, it ties into these underground bases and all these secret projects they're going on are going on in Area 51 and places like that around the world, and there are several. It somehow links into that. Again, we can't really show it as clearly as we can show what happened to the World Trade Center. But, this is a hugely important point for people to investigate and understand that. I can't really think of anything more important, than the ability to control the energy like this, and the ability to control the weather, for example. Those are hugely important things which affect everything else. They totally would change the geopolitical landscape of the world, if you understood that these things are real. And that's why I'm so very, forthright in trying to actually get people to look at this,
Yeah, I mean, it's sterling work what you're doing. I mean, going around giving these talks and everything, and we need more people like you. I mean, there's a lot of people in the States going about doing this sort of thing as well, but and of that many in this country. But it's really good. I mean, out of a lot of these groups, even the ones where that are being exposed as not being all they're claiming to be, there's always a few people that are breaking kicking off from it and actually looking at this information afresh. That's Judy Wood and yourself. And, you know, we're starting to do our best to, you know, expose what's being overlooked and what's being missed in terms
of... Well, thanks, yeah. You know, I mean, I appreciate, you know, that and appreciate you saying that. You know, it's something that I felt is... It's kind of like a calling, really. You know, it's not something I particularly wanted to do. And you know, all of these talks just about... the Derby ones, I suppose, the exception... You know, all of these talks I do by invitation. You know, people contact me and ask me to do them. I don't like the Derby thing, for example. I booked that myself. You know, I booked the place myself to run it. That's kind of the last time I did that was in 2009. You know, when that again was when Lloyd Pye came over with the latest batch of research he'd had done then. You know, and primarily this Derby event, without digressing too much. I wanted to organise that because he was going to be there, and then I thought, well, I might as well make it into a day-long event because people in the East Midlands apparently had written to Richard Hall and said, why haven't you done an event here? You know, because he'd done this UK tour and not been anywhere near. I don't think he'd even been to Birmingham, for example, which is not too far from here. You know, so I thought, well, yeah. let's get people together, and then I'll just, you know, I'll try and fill in one. Because I thought this people needed to hear this as well and make a day of it, you know, and that's what we're going to do. But normally, you know, I sort of ask to be invited, and it's, you know, that's for me has always worked the best, because then I know that people are curious, you know, to find out what I've, you know, a bit more about what I've posted on the website and stuff, and everything is posted there, really, you know. And And I'm hoping that, you know, people will get, you know, everything they need from that. And judging by the way that people write to me, sometimes they have, I think. But I think it always helps to meet up with people, you know, and interact with them. And I really like to try and do that, you know, and so that people can get to know me and I can get to know them a bit. And we can sort of share this one-to-one on a level and just, you know, and just... You know, I mean, it's not something to joke about, but it's not, you know, one of the important things is that we don't lose our sense of humour and stuff in all of this, because that's very deeply part of our humanity in this, and what we're seeing and looking at and reviewing is inhuman, you know, so we need to keep our humanity in this, and that's...
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, that's why we need to have these events, I think, and interact, and just keep trying to keep it, you know, in a way that we can deal with it, you know.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It's what I was saying the other night, we was on a talk, and I was saying, you know, people have got to stop being so afraid and start actually enjoying their lives in that sense. And
yeah,
you know, whatever rocks your boat, and as that, I don't know if you listened to the show just before that chap that was giving that talk about how to go about actually enjoying life, couldn't agree more with a lot of what he said. Yeah, this is how we've got to be, because these people want us to be miserable. They don't want us enjoying our lives. They want to keep us under control and feeding them, and you know, just keep us in this permanent state of misery, because that's what they seem to be happy with.
Yeah.
And we've got to you know, we've got to fight back against that. Yeah, it's a serious subject we're dealing with, and it's not very pleasant. At the end of the day, we have got to face and confront evil in that sense. But yeah, we've got to enjoy our lives as well, and we've got to keep a sense of humour and show these people that no matter what they can throw at us, they're not going to break us. They're not going to break our spirit, and they haven't done, or we wouldn't be here doing this now. So you know, that's the whole point, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. You know, and I think just to add to that, you know, what I've got, you know, I've got an email list, and I used to send out a lot more stuff than I do now. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, I used to send out more stuff. And it's easy to become caught up in, you know, a lot of these stories that get circulated. I've got a couple of people that send them, you know, oh, you know, everyone's going to get a chip in them, and they're now putting these chips in vaccines, and, you know, and then they're going to crash the economy next week, and then they're going to invade Iran the week after that, and then this and then that, you know, and a lot of these groups now, the alternative news groups, like, for example, InfoWars, and there are several others, they're generating as much fear as the mainstream media do, if not even worse, you know. And a lot of these things that they're claiming, and there's this big thing about smart meters in the US, you know. I mean, I'm not saying that these things aren't part of this larger sort of control agenda. They are, you know, and there's no doubt about it. But are you going to live in fear of them? Are you going to sort of say, oh, you know, it's the end of the world all the time? Or are you going to look at some of these other things and say, hang on, maybe there's some possibilities here that we need to look at and work on and try and talk about those a bit more? You know?
Yeah.
You know, and people talk about the control of the internet. Well, heck, well, you know, we're having this conversation, aren't we? You know, it can't be that control.
That's in control, yeah.
Yeah, you know,
so... I'm scared of it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it appears from where I'm standing that there are these opposing forces, and whilst there is definitely, something resembling the New World Order, well, I actually think the New World Order isn't coming. I think it's already here, and it's been here for... probably at almost 10 years at least, probably longer actually.
That's the way a lot of these politicians talk. We have a new world order, and they're talking as if, yeah, I, as far as they're concerned, yeah, I've already got it. Yeah.
Well, that's it. And I mean, you look in the mainstream news about, you know, how much they talk about the things like the World Health Organization. That's not so much, but you know, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the EU, you know, and all these things. And it's now more or less in the lingo that the EU dictates what happens. You know, you hear it so much now. You know, and I mean, really, that's the new world order. But you've got to realise that I think the machinery that we use, you know, like the internet and the things that we're doing, they need that machinery to keep this new world order running. And it's a bit like, you know, I used to do a bit of hacking of old... I suppose what I'm saying is that, you know, I used to do a bit of hacking of computer stuff. I started on the ZX Spectrum, and there was always a way in. Like, for example, to hack the Spectrum tapes, you always had to load the tape. So there was always a bit at the beginning that was a standard tape loader, and then what you do is you would hack that, and then go into the next bit and hack into it from there. So in other words, they've got to have all this technology around us to run this control agenda, which, you know, I think it's real. I think that's there. I'm not disputing that. But if we know how to hack it and we keep our wits about us, we can keep hacking it, and there ain't nothing they're going to be able to do about it, because we still have that, you know, as you say, they haven't broken our spirit. So we're still going to have the ingenuity, and where there's a will, there's a way. And we're going to keep hacking it, and we're going to keep, you know, beetling away and supplying people who are curious with the information they need to take them to the next step if they wish to take it. You know, so from that perspective, I'm optimistic. But from another perspective, I think, you know, that over the last 30 or 40 years, what's been done in education and the way that people are brainwashed through television, that very much restricts our audience down to a very small proportion of people. And then within that, I think that's why a lot of these truth groups are set up. The core truths that are the most important ones, like weather control and free energy control, they're the ones that they've managed to divide down and keep down at the lowest level, because they're the key ones that they need to keep out of people's sort of consciousness, really.
Yeah, that's right, and it's they've gone extraordinary lengths. Well, I'll get out in a minute. They've gone to quite extraordinary lengths to keep us in the mindset and the lives that we've got. Mm. And it's more about us than it does them, because look at what they've had to go through to achieve what they claim to have over us. They don't have the control over us. I think they have. Obviously so, because, you know, they like to control what we think or how we think, but it obviously isn't affecting the entire population, or I say we wouldn't be here, we'll be having this, this conversation. So that's the thing, and I'm the same as you. I'll keep optimistic, and I'm very hopeful about, you know, the way people are going to finally wise up and wake up to this. It's going to take time, and it's going to you know, it's maybe not going to be as smooth and as some people would like it to be, especially with all this stuff that's supposedly coming in, you know, in December in 2012 and all this stuff. But you know, there's always something to be scared of, isn't it? Isn't there? Which is what they're forever trying to put in their faces. I mean, the Olympics has just passed. We were talking about this the other day. Mm. The Olympics has passed with that incident, and there was all this, paranoia and anxiety of what was going to take place, and then it's just passed with that incident. And it had the effect they wanted anyway. They didn't have to let a bomb off or you know, have another false flag. They got us in the state of mind they wanted us in beforehand. And that was good enough. They didn't actually have to orchestrate anything. And that's how we have to understand this is how these people work.
Yeah.
And so, we generally will lose our fear of them, you know, in that sense.
Right. And I think, you know, because they're working so hard to keep us in a state of fear, that must be one of the things that they need to have. You know, so if we can get away from the fear, you know, there's that phrase that comes up, you know, it's a choice between fear or love. And I think it's true. I think that if you can, you know, if you can get away from the fear and move towards the love or whatever other word you guess a substitute, if I just move away from the fear, then you're on the right road, and you're already reducing their ability to control you, because that's one of the main ways through which the control works is through fear. And as I say, they don't really care whether that comes from rumour, you know, speculation, or whether it comes from mainstream media, or whether it comes from Infowars.com or any of these other sites. You know, as long as they can keep people in a state of fear, that keeps them, you know, under control.
That's right.
You know, and I've tried to move away from that more and more, and just sort of think, well, you know, we're in this boat now. The sea is sort of a bit choppy and stuff, and there's some crap being thrown overboard into where we're sitting and stuff, quite a lot of it. But, you know, we've still got our head above water, we can see out, you know, and we can keep going for a bit yet, and try and see if we can at some point get a hold and start steering the boat, you know, whatever. And
I think we're in the early stages of doing that.
I agree with you. You know, it's going to take time, and my own personal sort of philosophy on this is that I don't know whether anything's going to change that much in my own lifetime. I really don't know. But hopefully, if it doesn't, we're laying the foundation, you know, individually and collectively, for whatever comes afterwards. You know, it might sound a bit sort of trite.
I think you're right. Yeah, that's the way I look at it. Is I don't expect it to change in my lifetime. I really hope it does. Obviously, like anyone else, but you know, it's this what I'm doing, myself and yourself, and you know, and everyone else who's involved in all this. We're doing this for the next generation and our kids, you know, and they're the ones who are going to ultimately reap what we're sowing. And you know, we just have to sit back and accept that to a certain degree, that we're not going to. Although we're fighting these people, you know, we're not going to have the freedom we really want. It's not us who are going to enjoy that, but it's going to be the next generation. And that's ultimately what we're fighting for, because if we don't have a future, there's nothing we're fighting for anyway. So, you know, this is what this is all about. So we've ultimately got a future.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. But anyway, I don't know if you want to take a break. Do you need it?
Yeah, can I have a bit of a break, yeah.
Sure, mate. Yeah, we've been going on quite a bit.
Yeah,
great. Yeah, so if you like, we'll chuck a bit of music on, and we'll take a break for about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll pop back. And I'd like to talk about the other subjects you go into on your website, and mainly about this thing about the expanding Earth.
Okay,
I'm quite interested in talking about that, the last part. So yeah, we'll take a break for now. We'll catch you all later. We'll catch you all in about 10 minutes. Thanks ever so much for listening. And we'll be back soon. Hello and welcome back again to Factually Speaking. This is Vince James, and I've got Andrew Johnson still with me. And we've just been spending the first part of the talk going over most of the 9/11 issue and the evidence that's now coming to light regarding what really happened that day. And I'd like now, if I can, Andrew, talk with you about the other issues and subjects you cover on your website. Hmm. And I was at your talk the other day, as you know, I bought some CDs and I've gone for a few of them already. But the one that fascinated me the most was a DVD about the expanding Earth theory.
Hmm.
Now, as I was telling you, I've spent most of my life studying paleontology and geology, that sort of thing, and just as a hobby. I'm not an expert or anything, but in terms of what I've learnt about it, I've sort of, like many people in science or have studied sciences, I've stuck with a status quo about how you think the world was formed and how it works. And from what you were showing in the talk you was giving in the video, it was showing that possibly I've got that one wrong as well. So would you like to sort of expand a little bit more on that, about how you came by learning this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something I think I first came across in about 2006, and people can easily come across what I came across if they Google Neil Adams and then Expanding Earth. Neil is spelt with an A, N-E-A-L, Adams. And yeah, I saw these videos where what he's done is like a computer animation, and he basically takes away the ocean floor around the planet, and he moves the continents, together, having removed the ocean floor. And this is done as like a gradual process in an animation. And the thing that comes out is that all the continents fit together on a smaller globe. And you think, well, that's very interesting. That must be a trick of computer animation, because that idea is clearly nonsense. But then, you know, you start to look into it a bit more. And I mean, just to go back a slight step, you know, everyone's seen, and, you know, you do read about this in the textbooks, that if you know, the most obvious one is that if you get the eastern side of South America, you can fit that into the western side of Africa on the map. You know, it's plain as day. You can see that very clearly, and you can see that one or two other bits and pieces appear to fit together. And of course, if you read the textbooks about what things were like, millions of years ago, they claim that there was this, all the landmass was joined into one supercontinent called Pangaea. And then that was just surrounded by, they don't even say what it was surrounded by particularly. It wasn't surrounded by oceans, because there weren't originally any deep oceans on the Earth. There were only shallow seas. And so you think, oh yeah, well obviously, the continents fit together, and Pangaea is, the obvious explanation for that. In traditional geology and so on, traditional plate tectonics. But this idea of the continents moving around was also itself heresy up until about the late 50s. I'd heard about this, I think we were taught at school about the ideas of continental drift, because I was at school in the 70s and 80s, so this idea of continental drift was reasonably well established by then, and we were taught that that's what happened. We were taught about this thing called plate tectonics, and so what plate tectonics basically says is that the Earth's crust is kind of like floating on the Earth's mantle, which is a molten material, and the continental crust is moving around, and the continents actually collide into each other, and at some points The continental plate goes under the ocean plate, and plate gets destroyed and gets remelted under the Earth's mantle. And at the other side of the plate, we've got new plate being created at the ocean floor, and this is what's causing the continental drift. So at one plate boundary, you've got destruction, or subduction as they call it, of the continental plate. And at the other plate boundary on the other side, you have the creation of new material. And they've seen this, and they knew this in the 50s and 60s, because they mapped the ocean floor using data which looked at the Earth's magnetic field switching approximately, I think, every 100,000 years or something, or 25,000 years. I can't remember the figure exactly, but they discovered from this survey, and this is well established by the USGS, and there's this very famous map that you can look at called the Rainbow Map, I think is the name given to it, that the oldest ocean floor anywhere on the planet Earth is 180 million years. And this doesn't really make any sense, because the oldest, you know, that means that, from their model of things, this plate tectonics thing, this continental drift or whatever it is, only started 180 million years ago, and no one's really sought to explain that, what would ever cause that. The other thing which came out a few years ago, and was never really spoken about that much, I think it came out in the late 90s, was that they'd measured over a period of time that the Earth's diameter was actually increasing, and it appeared to have increased over a period of 10 years or so, at a rate of about 18 millimeters a year. And this was measured with, satellites which could make geodetic measurements. And they just said, oh, well, the Earth's obviously not expanding. That would be ridiculous. We know it's always been the same size. So we'll just say that that was an instrument error and forget about it. Which is what they did. But when I began to study this a little bit more, I came across a guy called Professor S. Warren Carey, and he was looking at earlier research as well, trying to remember the name of the earlier guys. It was in, I think, in the 1930s. I'll try and get the name up if I can. Somebody proposed this idea that the Earth had been smaller in the past than it is now. And he actually did a set of three models showing that the continents fitted together on a smaller globe. This was Carey then took this up, and what he found was that when he was looking at this continental drift idea in the sort of 40s and 50s, he'd already fitted together South America and Africa, as I've mentioned before, and he'd done the best that he could on the map, and he'd drawn a grid and, you know, mapped it all out as best he could with the data he had at the time. First fitted the continents together in 1933, S. Warren Carey. And then he realised that if he took this data about the Earth being smaller in size and being smaller in diameter, he got an even better fit for the curvature of these continents, because he realised there were certain curvature issues, you know, around the surface of the Earth. And he got a better fit on a smaller globe. And then when he looked at the rest of the continents, it became very clear to him, as it will to you if you look at it, that the continents will fit together on both sides, both on the Atlantic separation and on the Pacific separation side. They fit together perfectly on a smaller globe. Further to this, you know, the thing that really sold it for me, I'd seen the Neil Adams videos, and I was fairly sort of convinced. But oddly, the thing that I hadn't come across was the science. I'd come across Neil Adams's analysis. Neil Adams is actually a comic book artist. He isn't a scientist, yet it was his analysis and his presentation on Coast to Coast, the US talk radio program, which I came across first in 2006. But there's an Australian geologist called Dr. James Maxlow, and he did his PhD on this data about the expanding Earth, and he'd done an awful lot of research. I was actually quite staggered to see how much he'd done. And he built all these models, and he'd mapped out the expansion back into the into the time of the dinosaurs, and he'd measured the rate of expansion, and he'd averaged it out at 14 millimeters a year, and he'd worked out this figure before this figure that I mentioned earlier of 18 millimeters a year, which came up from geodesic measurements from satellites. He'd come up with 14 millimeters a year before that was even published, and it was in very close agreement. So that was pretty good. And what he'd done is, as well as matching the continents, he'd gone around and matched the actual geology. So in other words, where you've got these boundaries and where the continents have previously been joined together, he actually went and looked at the geology from those areas, you know, from all the information that was available at that time. You know, was it igneous rock? Was it, you know, higher than normal proportion of quartz? Was it a lot of sandstone or whatever the type of rock was? You know, he matched that all up, and he's shown this on these globes. So he matched all that up. And he also matched up the types of fossils that were found in those regions. He also matched up data from ancient coral reefs. And he matched all of this stuff up. And guess what? It all matched. All these different, I think it's four or five different types of data. Let's see, I forgot the list here. Bringing this up. He matched up various different types of data to show that, that this is indeed what appeared to have happened, that the Earth had expanded. Ancient climate he looked at as well. Ancient geography, ancient biography, biogeography, that's the coral reefs, and the modern geodetic measurements, and they all, Maxwell calculated 22 millimetres a year expansion rate, not 14 millimetres a year. But it was still pretty close agreement. I went 4 millimetres in the wrong direction. You know, you need to obviously just look at this yourself to see where his data come from. And James Macklin has a presentation on YouTube showing some of the models that he built over a period of years. And he also mentions other researchers like Klaus Vogel, who'd also worked on this, and S. Warren Carey, who'd also worked on this for decades. And these people are all, you know, again, kept out of the mainstream science. They're not really, you know, their stuff is not mentioned in schools.
They're all ridiculed.
They're all ridiculed. And one of the other things I came across, which perhaps intrigued me, you know, even more, was to do with the dinosaurs, because it had come up somewhere in one of these web pages that I'd read, you know, why were the dinosaurs so big? I mean, if you had a dinosaur of the same size on the current modern Earth, it would have died immediately because it couldn't have supported its own weight. And I came across a web page which pointed out a particular mystery, and that's the mystery of the Brachiosaurus, because the Brachiosaurus had an extremely long neck, and it was said to have used this extremely long neck, you know, to feed from the tall trees, you know, and that's what we've seen in all these books that we read as kids, you know, all this type of thing. So what's going on with that? Well, it appears that the Brachiosaurus, its heart couldn't have pumped the blood up to its head when it's had its neck raised. So they came up with various ways of trying to explain this, such as the Brachiosaurus having three or four hearts, or it never actually, fed from the tops of trees after all, you know. And they said that it didn't need to support its own weight because it lived in a swamp, so it spent most of the time with half its weight supported by water, or watery, you know, marsh-type material or whatever.
Well, they knew that if its chest was below water and it opened its nostrils at the top, its lungs would collapse, so it couldn't have been in water.
But
it's been water just on that alone. But I mean, from what we know of dinosaurs, I mean, obviously these things existed and got to that size, but it's from what we know about them is there's no other creature on Earth like them today, and their biology as such is quite different from any other large animal, even an elephant. An elephant is actually its biology, even though it's a mammal, its biology and the way it actually operates is quite different from a lot of other mammals because of its size. So it does appear that Mother Nature, if an animal does get that large, it finds a way of coping with it, finds a way of dealing with it. And I mean, in terms of the skeletal mass of dinosaurs, their bones were hollow and full of air. They were designed like a even a brachiosaur had a very similar skeleton to a bird. So even though you'd think this was a really big, heavy animal, skeletal-wise, its skeleton was actually very light and quite brittle in that sense.
Well, I mean, you know, the argument that's made in the stuff that I was reading was that the skeletal skeleton may have been lighter, but the body weight, you know, the mass of flesh and stuff, should have essentially been on a par with, you know, because if you look at the body mass of an elephant, I mean, it's probably, you know, it's probably the same sort of density as a rhinoceros, for example. I can't imagine it being that much different. And if you work out the mechanics, I mean, this is something that Stephen Hurrell has done. He's got a book called Dinosaurs and the Expanding Earth, and he does some basic mechanics. And you look at the bone structure from the fossils and the cross-section area of the bone, and you work out the body mass of these creatures, you know, based on the weight of the flesh. And, you know, because, I mean, they were probably a similar sort of percentage water to what we are. You know, work that percentage out. And it looks as if the dinosaurs couldn't have actually supported their own weight you know, in terms of the weight of the flesh that they carried. And also you look at things like, you know, even if you take the argument of the different types of skeleton on the dinosaurs, you also have the giant plant life and you have these giant insects as well. And, you know, there's a famous one of an insect, Meganeura, was an eagle-sized dragonfly with a wingspan of 75 centimetres. You know, and how did its exoskeleton support its weight? How did it breathe? And this sort of thing. So the conclusion that some people have come to is that when the dinosaurs were on the Earth and these insects were growing to enormous size, well, guess what? The force of gravity was lower, and that would tie in with there being a smaller Earth, because if the Earth was smaller, there wouldn't have been as much mass. And it's the mass of an object which is said to create the force of gravity. So, it looks as if a smaller sphere of Earth would have a lower force of gravity. Therefore, these creatures could grow to a larger physical size with the same sort of materials being used for their construction. And I think that's a perfect logical solution to some of these problems. You know, and certainly the problem with birds, for example, which is much more extreme. Because birds, you know, well, not so much birds, but the flying dinosaurs. And the example that I came across was, there were a couple of examples actually, but Quetzalcoatlus was one, and the other one was the Argentavis, which was a huge bird-like dinosaur, which had a sort of like a around 25-foot wingspan or something, a huge thing. And in today's gravity, that could never have flown. The aerodynamics and so on, the lift that it generated, wouldn't have ever got it off the ground. So, you know, that's pretty much a thing that couldn't have flown in with the Earth as it is today. So, yes, somebody's got some explaining to do.
I mean, it's to me, the way I've always looked at it is, you know, even though these creatures seem impossible, the sizes they reached and what they were capable of, it seems to me as though nature somehow finds a way around it. Even if it's something that isn't present now in modern day animals, whatever methods Mother Nature came up with to overcome these problems, it would do it. And this has always been shown throughout animals. I mean, it's the same with, A giraffe has certain issues regarding blood pressure if it puts its head down to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would happen is when it puts its head down to drink, because the blood pressure is so high in that animal, it would cause the too much blood to rush to the brain too quickly, which could cause it to kill it. So it Mother Nature just decided to put a sponge in its brain to stop that from happening. So when it put its head down, you know, it found a way of coping with it. And this is what we find in all animals. Whenever their size or a certain feature of their anatomy would otherwise cause a problem, nature seems to find a way to get around it. And even with early mammals on the planet, what we find with fossils of them, if they're preserved well enough, we can actually find traces of their blood paths and everything. And what we found is that early mammals weren't put together quite the same way as what mammals are today. So they evolved and they changed as time went on. In some cases, some mammals were actually better better adapted than modern day animals. Some animals, you know, we had a mixture of good and bad. It isn't an issue of we've got modern day animals now, and this is as good as they could have possibly got. And animals previous to them were inferior. That isn't necessarily the case. We've got a bit of a mix and a match, which is why we've still got coelacanths knocking about. Because if an animal finds a niche where it can survive and it's not going to be disturbed and it hasn't got a reason to adapt to change, it will pretty much stay as it is. And that's what we found with a lot of creatures.
Yeah, I mean, there may be some of that in terms of maybe stuff about the dinosaurs that we don't know. And I mean, certainly for example, with the giraffe, we can know, you know, what you said about the blood pressure. And I didn't know that, and that's very interesting. But I think what we can say is that we have enough information on the giraffes. So, you know, we can get a dead giraffe and look inside its brain and find the sponge sort of thing. So we know how that bit works. And it's probably true to say, obviously, that we can't do it to the same extent with the dinosaurs. However, I think if you were to perform the calculations for the skeleton of a giraffe, and you know the density of the bone and so on, and you can physically determine what the bone is made of in terms of, you know, being calcium-based compounds and so on, and then you can work out the structural strength of that bone and divide that by the cross-sectional area, I don't think you're going to find any problems with the calculation. But from what my understanding is about the calculations that have been done on the mechanics, I'm talking about the mechanics rather than the physiology of the animals. I mean, there are certain aspects of the physiology with the Brachiosaurus that I mentioned, which may, you know, that particular one, there may be an explanation such as the one that you've proposed, you know, that it did have some kind of, some multiple-chambered heart that was, you know, more powerful than the ones that animals have now, and so on. There could be, and that people have already proposed that sort of explanation. But I think the problem, as I understand it, particularly, comes is when you look at the cross-sectional area of the bone, because, you know, I think there are only certain upper and lower limits between the strength of bone, you know, and why do we not have dinosaurs now? You know, animals that are big now, what made them suddenly become smaller? You know, all the animals, why don't we have huge animals now? You know, I mean,
that's right, yeah. But I mean, that happened during the Permian extinction as well. I mean, the big extinction that we know of that happened on the planet was during that period, and that was 250 million years ago. And you're saying from these calculations of the Earth expanding, this expansion seems to take place around 180 million years ago.
Well, that's, is that right? That's apparently, you'd have to check the figures that James Maxwell details, but he talks about an exponential expansion where it had been expanding before that, but there was something that happened approximately 180 million years ago. It caused the rate of expansion to increase exponentially. So to be right on what he's discovered, he says that the main, you know, a lot of the expansion happened starting 180 million years ago, but it was still expanding before then.
So yeah, I mean, the dinosaurs died. The continents as we know it, the way the Earth is now, apparently, from what we know, that's how it was 65 million years ago, or even just before that. The dinosaurs died out as the Earth is now. But they were still around, they still appeared healthy to a certain degree, and they slowly started dying out over it. But they reckon at least a 100,000-year cycle, which is literally a blink of an eye in geological terms.
Well, I think the people that have looked into the expanding Earth would argue, if you go back to 65 million years ago, which is when the dinosaurs were, I think if you look at Maxlow's calculations, I think you'll find that the Earth, as he calculated it, was with something like two-thirds of its present size, or maybe three-quarters. And, of course, you know, looking at that from an engineering perspective, in terms of if these, you know, the way that the skeletal structures work, you may have reached an upper limit of the strength of those skeletons. So it might have been the expansion of the Earth was one of the factors that caused them to die out. And it,
possibly,
you know,
yeah.
You know, if you look at the fossil record, you may find, I don't know if this is true, and this is entirely speculation on my part at this point because I haven't looked at the data, But it would be interesting to see if the larger dinosaurs died out first, you know, and there was a sort of like a sliding scale where the larger ones died out first and the smaller ones survived for longer. And again, I don't know whether that's true, but if that was the case, then it would support that the Earth expansion had something to do with the effects on the dinosaurs, you know, sort of skeletons and some of their physiology. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but from what we can tell, this is science, whether it's being covered up or not, you know, there's certain things that are being hidden from us, but from what we can tell, when the dinosaurs finally did die out, it was the sorts of creatures that were left over were usually no bigger than a cat, they believe, or even a small dog. But animals bigger than that can still survive the day, obviously, with the planet as it is.
Right.
So.
Right.
It's difficult. I mean, we just don't know really the truth. I mean, the theories, even when I was studying this and before I got into all this, you know, alternative knowledge, you know, subjects, I never really bought any of the alleged theories on the extinctions, even going back to the Permian extinction. It just doesn't make sense that the theories just don't fit the evidence. But, I mean, obviously, we've got evidence of meteorites. Right, it's hitting us, and that's no surprise. That's going to happen one way or the other. You know, it doesn't matter whether they were a direct or indirect cause or not. But, yeah, I mean, it is interesting. And this whole size issue is one of the things that's always bugged me. Why is it a certain sized animal did die out before others? And that selection of animals that went. I mean, obviously, the birds survived. It wasn't an issue for them. And certain sea creatures died out as well when others didn't, and yeah, it is a mystery. It doesn't fit. It doesn't seem to make sense compared to what's being put forward for it. But
I mean, this, you know, this, going into the sort of whole evolution thing. I mean, that's one thing that, you know, listening to Lloyd Pye has raised some very serious questions in my mind. For example, if you look at, you know, the standard thing is that we're our closest relatives are chimps, and we're supposed to have somehow evolved from them. But that's clearly impossible, as I now understand things, because, for example, chimpanzees are 10 times stronger for their body weight than we are. You know, that one fact right there, it should be a red flag. And also things like the other major one is the subcutaneous fat, you know, the fat that's under your skin. Chimps don't have that. We do. So where did it come from? The subcutaneous fat, as I understand it, is a common trait of aquatic creatures, aquatic mammals. And there's a book called The Aquatic Ape, which I think goes into this fact in a lot more detail.
I remember this when I was studying myself, and that there was this theory that came about that we were allegedly evolving to go back into the water, which is why our hair is...
Yes.
Goes backwards and things like that, and yet our bodies are very well designed to actually move in the water.
Exactly, and you know, the hair issue with the chimpanzees. We have hair in the opposite places to where chimpanzees have them, I think. You know, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So,
if true with the science, I mean, they claim that we was almost wiped off the planet about 100,000 years ago. There was what's called a bottleneck, where there was very, very few of us left, and or at least our ancestors, put it that way, not in human terms, not modern day humans, but again, that doesn't make sense regarding certain fossils on that have been found and the science behind it. And I think that our species, humans, have been here a hell of a lot longer than 100,000 years. Because we haven't evolved that quickly.
No, I agree.
Yeah, you know, we haven't just come about at the flick of a switch.
I mean, again, if you look at Michael Cremo's research, I don't know if you've looked into that at all. He's documented cases of human-like beings, you know, to 2 million years ago, just the same as we are, you know.
Yeah.
In the archaeological record, if you look hard enough for it, so he contends that there's something going on with that.
Yeah, there certainly does seem to be a suppression of certain fossils and relics that are being found.
Exactly.
And I was aware of that even when I was studying. You know, there seem to be some very odd things going on sometimes that you came across. But it was, I wasn't involved in any of this then, so it didn't get my attention that much. But even then, like I say, I didn't buy a lot of the stories and a lot of theories behind it, and that's where I was trying to take a lot of my study into. But obviously, I needed to get me out. I was studying for a degree at the time myself, and I wanted to make that more of a part of doing my doctorate and that, when if and when it was going to happen. But it's all got put on a back burner now because I'm doing all this. So see, that's the thing. It's a fascinating subject, and it does appear as though with everything we think we know about this world, all of it's back to front. None of it is what we've been led to believe it is. Right from our evolution, what we're doing here, and what created and brought about the planet the way it is, and then just our everyday bloody lives, everything we've ever been taught, we've basically been lied to. Nothing like what you think. It is. It's incredible. So it goes to show you've got to have an open mind to this, and you've got to question absolutely everything, and it can drive you mad. I know.
You've got
to pick your subjects and pick your battles. I know, and you've got to but just keep an open mind to it, and it is. It's absolutely fascinating, this subject. And
it is. I mean, one mention is Lloyd Pye's book, Everything You Know Is Wrong. If you can get a hold of a copy of it, you might find that's quite interesting. It goes into some of the things about evolution and hominids and hominoids. It's that taught me a few things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly going to look a bit deeper into it, but obviously, for me, from what I've already learnt and understand already, I've got to look at it from a factual perspective and see what evidence there really is there of this. But yeah, I mean, from what I saw in the videos and that, when they actually show you how the Earth can actually fit together once they start, it's like a balloon, obviously, once they squeeze it down, and you actually see the continents, they do come together absolutely perfectly, where I've never really thought of it that way, especially with the oceans. It makes sense with the oceans suddenly appearing.
Yeah.
Because if they're saying there were shallow oceans, well then for them to suddenly become deep, miles deep, they've got to have sunk into the Earth. That wouldn't have happened under continental drift.
Yeah, there's no explanation for that, if you think about it.
Yeah. And that makes absolute sense. And when I saw that, I thought, blimey, they're on the same here,
Yeah.
So it's going to be something I'm certainly going to look a lot more into. And, I'm not going to do my head in trying to understand it or a lot of it, because it's just one of those things. A lot of this stuff, we're never going to get to the bottom of it one way or the other. But I'm certainly interested in Lloyd Pye's talk. And your event's going to be in Derby, did you say?
That's right, at the end of this month, So
and the details are on your website.
Correct. So if anybody's listening and they want to check it out, then you can at least have a look. And, we've got plenty of left.
I'll try and make it to that if I can. Then I'd love to come.
Yeah, by all means. Yeah.
And with Lloyd Pye with the Star Child skull. I mean, when we was at the talk the other night, I managed to get in a quick question, and the question was, if I remember it, that the DNA that you found within the Star Child skull was actually sort of identical to any DNA that we find in animals on this planet. And he said, well, it's made of the same stuff. So that basically means that the map, the genetic map, is the same for an alien as it is for us. So that means it's across the universe. That means the genetic sort of map, if you like, for putting everything, any type of life form together, is exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's what blew my mind more than anything. And so there you have it. Even though a creature can be put together in a totally foreign way to what it is on this planet, i.e. an alien, the actual blueprint, the map that makes it happen, does it, is exactly the same. We're all made of exactly the same thing, i.e. the DNA. The DNA is the same. And so, that's huge, that is, in terms of discovery and science. But it seems as though they're trying to obviously debunk his work, but they're obviously trying to stop him from getting this information out to the public. I think no government sponsored or run research laboratory or anything will actually help him out on this, will they? Will actually doing the test that he wants to do on the skull, he's had to do a lot of this through private. laboratories, I believe, isn't he?
Right. Yeah, it's done in a private lab, so yeah.
Yeah, well, at least in that sense, we can get more credible results and data from them. We know it's not going to be fiddled, as in, you know, the way a lot of this a lot of these results and science gets put through.
Right.
But it's one of these things of, you know, when is a day going to come when he can finally, you know, do all the testing he's going to want to do on that. And prove it once and for all what it really is. I mean, I believe from what he's already done with the test they got done last year with his shotgun, the shotgun tests, as they call them, for testing it, they found that this thing there is 100% alien.
That's what it appears to be from the evidence they've gathered of the DNA. It's, you know, it's got certain sequences which match up with a few creatures on Earth, but overall, there's too many differences in too many cases that cannot be anything like human.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? But if it can happen, it will happen, and has happened, and there we have it. We've finally got some proof that these, you know, we're not alone in the universe. That's what this really means. We're not alone, and there is life out there. If ever you needed proof of it anyway, here we are.
There's lots of evidence
it's fascinating that, and I'd love to come to that talk of Lloyd's as well, and
it's only about a mile from the train station, so I don't know whether you plan on driving, but you can get from London to Derby fairly easily on the train. It's a, you know, there's a fairly regular service in that, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you have to get tickets on your site, do you?
Yeah, I've put a thing to get tickets via PayPal, £15 for the whole day, so try to keep the cost down, you know.
Oh, it's an all-day event?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to try and make it down for that. Hang on, someone's just asked me a message here. Recall you mentioned a Mid-Atlantic Trench. Does Andrew see the same, the tree trunk expansive?
I don't understand
the tree trunk expansive, but I know what he means, yeah.
No, I'm not familiar. Is that something, if you know what he means, maybe you can answer his question?
Well, the Mid-Atlantic Trench, it's where it obviously the ocean starts, where they're claiming under the, you know, where the Earth's expanding, mm-hmm. You're actually seeing it pull apart, you know, right. How would you explain it if it's coming apart like that? It's like plasticine, isn't it, as you're pulling it apart?
Yeah, to some extent.
It's the cracks, I suppose, isn't it? Yeah. But it makes sense in terms of, you know, how the oceans are actually appearing from that sense, you know, if the Earth is expanding. And so, I mean, are they still claiming that the subduction is still actually taking place?
No, there's no subduction in expanding Earth. It's not
really. No subduction at all? Yeah.
Not at all. So the effects that they're claiming as subduction are just a different effect. So it's extra expansion effects that Maxlow says that's what they're seeing. Because you get, in other words, you get, I think Maxlow's argument, if you listen to his talk and look at his PhD paper, he basically argues that the effects that they're claiming are due to subduction are not due to that, and there's no proof that they're due to that. That's just their idea. He says that equally you could argue that it's due to expansion effects, you know, that are causing the continental plates to sort of shift around, you know, in a slightly different sense because of the change in curvature as the Earth expands, which is a very big factor that he points out, which is quite obvious when you look at it. You know, so that's I think, one of the key things to think about. 'Cause in other words, if the Earth is indeed expanding, and you've got these, you know, plates shaped to the sphere, then when the Earth expands, those plates which are essentially rigid, which are shaped onto a smaller sphere, have to change their curvature to fit on the larger sphere, so they collapse. And it's these sorts of effects that you see, which are creating the, you know, volcanic effects and the fracturing and so on. It's not subduction. And I think he's got a very good argument there.
Yeah, so I mean, the Earth's core isn't what they're claiming it is, then, in terms of that respect, is it?
No, not according to him. He claims there's some energy source there, you know, somewhere
we are getting magnetic field from it, aren't we?
Well, that's it, you know, and that's always a bit of a mystery. There's various people try to explain it and they claim to have explained it, but I don't know how good that explanation is, you know, when you actually try and break it down more.
Yeah, because obviously we're still getting magma coming through and fissures and volcanoes and everything else. So it's strange to try, you know, like I say, it's trying to model it in my own head now. How could it possibly work if it is expanding and where is it?
I'd suggest, you know, if you go and dig out that you can still get the books by S. Warren Carey, and you obviously know more about geology and stuff than I do. I know bits and pieces, as you can see. I've got a sort of sketchy knowledge of it. But I'd recommend you go and get Carey's books. And in fact, one of them is available on Google Books. So you could have a scan through some of that and see where it takes you. Because he clearly knew what he was talking about. Carey was a brilliant mind. So if you go and look at that, I'm sure that'll get you down the road at some distance, I would think. Better than it could for me.
Mm. Yeah, I'll certainly give it all a look, and you know, it is just mind blowing to think that, you know, it'll be true. But I mean, we do see it with other planets. We see this is how supernovas take
there
off.
There you go.
They claim the planet expands until it hits a certain size, when it hits a threshold, and then it'll explode. It'll implode in on itself. And then blow out, and that's when we see supernovas and that.
That's right.
They're admitting there that a planet can expand. Can,
and you know what about the asteroid belt? Some say that's an exploded planet. Maybe that was a planet that grew to such a size and then expanded and decided to blow itself apart.
Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? So anyway, I think I'm going to have to go and get some shut eye because I'm sort of starting to feel like falling asleep now.
Yes, I'm flagging a bit myself. So we've got about half hour over nearly, which is brilliant for the first show anyway.
at least it shows we
can keep it going. But thanks ever so much for coming on. It's been absolutely brilliant, and I hope to see you at the end of the month at Derby. I really fancy coming down for that. If you want to plug your website again, what's it called?
It's checktheevidence.com, so you can have a look at that.
Okay, and thank you ever so much for coming on. It's been terrific. And if you what was I going to say? Sorry, if you want to look at my own website, it's nostateprojectsuk.co.nr, and this is Awake Radio on awakeradio.co.uk. And my next show is going to be on Sunday. No State Project UK again, and I'll see you all then. Thanks ever so much for listening, and we'll hopefully catch you on the next show. So take care, Errol, and thanks ever so much, Andrew, for coming on.
Thank you,
and I hope you come back again. I'd love to have you back on the show again, and we can go deeper into this.
Yeah, no problem.
So great, I've got it, mate. All right, well, thank you all, and I'll hand you back over to Steve. Thank you ever so much for hosting it again for me tonight. And we'll see you all again when we see you.